and AJ, I owe you an apology. I am so, so sorry that I ever allowed you to think that you were important in this company. And I should have told you a long, long time ago that you have never been anything more than a little bit better than an average fish in any pond. And this whole phenomenal one stuff, it's an illusion, a marketing gimmick for all of those wonderful five-star matches that you used to have. And I say used to have because I can't freaking remember the last time you had one. And you know what else? You would be lucky if we call you the marginal one, because I swear you are nothing. You are nothing like you used to be.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
That was Dixie Carter's heel turn on AJ Styles at the end of Impact Wrestling Thursday night. We have the evil female boss talking to her top babyface, telling him that he's only better than average. He's just not that good. I could swear I heard this somewhere else before. I can't quite put my finger on it. While I try to figure that out, we'll get to that later on in the show. This is episode 293 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 22nd, 2013, the last day of summer. It's very depressing. I believe summer is only first beginning for those of you down in Australia. So I may have to put that down as a place I visit in the very near future. By the way, in case I forgot to mention it, you can listen to this show each and every week, exclusively on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and in iTunes. And of course, we also have a free Solid Monster Sounds Off app in the Google Play Store for those of you with Android devices. If the show sounds any different to you this week, it's because I'm using a different microphone setup. I actually went out yesterday and purchased some equipment to try to make things sound a little bit better. I know sometimes there's an issue with a humming in the background, which comes from the motor on the laptop. Not really a whole lot I can do. So I've gotten the microphone off the desk here. I am looking at a microphone stand and gooseneck in my face. I actually went to Sam Ash. I don't think I've ever been in a Sam Ash in my entire life. I didn't even know Sam Ash was still in business. But lo and behold, there's one not far from where I live. So I went there and found what I was looking for. And so I need your feedback. Let me know what you think. If the show sounds exactly the same, nothing really has changed. If it sounds better slightly, if it sounds worse for some reason, this is what your PayPal dollars are going towards, going right back into the show to help make it better. But I need your feedback to know if this will work or if we should just go back to the way it was before. So email me, tweet me, Facebook me, what have you. Let me know what you think when the show's over this week. I very much appreciate that. Last Sunday was the WWE Night of Champions pay-per-view in Detroit. I went 6-1 in my predictions, and as far as pay-per-views are concerned, this was probably, if not the worst, certainly one of the worst WWE pay-per-views of the year. I thought overall this was just a terrible show. There was some good wrestling on it. I thought the main event was very good. Main event was not enough to save this show. I think when you pay whatever it is that you pay, whether you're paying $45 or if you're paying $55, you come to expect that you're going to get a pay-per-view level show. And one comment I saw a lot of people making, and I absolutely agree, is that when the show was over, at best, it came across as a glorified edition of Raw. Well, I get 3 hours of Raw for free every Monday night. I don't want to pay $50 to watch a glorified edition of Raw with commercials, because now they have commercials on pay-per-view, which is completely ridiculous. Some people thought so much of this pay-per-view, they actually called up their cable company and got a refund. They actually demanded a refund for the show because they ended up overturning the outcome of the main event the next night, among other things. They probably just didn't think it was a very good show. They didn't get their money's worth. And the cable company gave them their money back. And WWE actually had to issue a statement saying, you know, while we understand some fans may not have been very happy with the way that the event went the night before, We're certain that the three-hour pay-per-view event delivered all the entertainment and excitement expected from WWE. When I read that, I laughed, because, of course, that's bullshit. It was not a good show, but at the same time, you know, it's a slippery slope, I guess, that you're walking here where people watch a show and they just happen not to like what they see. They're going to call and demand a refund. You still got a three-hour pay-per-view. I am sympathetic to these people because they do feel ripped off. I could see where people would feel ripped off. It wasn't a good show. If it was a good pay-per-view with a shitty finish, it would be like, well, you know, you still got a good pay-per-view. From their perspective, they got a shitty pay-per-view with a shitty finish. So I sympathize. I don't know about actually giving refunds to people, though. That's a little much. You know, going to a live event where, let's say, John Cena or CM Punk is advertised, and they don't show up because they're injured or whatever the case may be, and they don't advertise that in advance, that's a different story. That's a bait and switch. WWE will often issue refunds or offer refunds to people if they want. Sometimes they take them up on it, sometimes they don't. Here, they gave you the entire advertised card. It's not like they pulled, you know, Daniel Bryan from the show or CM Punk no-showed or something like that. You got exactly what you expected to see. It's just that people felt ripped off. I don't know that I'd give them their money back. I would think next time they'll think twice before they order a WWE pay-per-view. And there's two of them coming up next month. I don't really think that this show did them any favors in terms of getting people excited for Battleground on October 6th. So let's just run through this really quickly here. Primetime Players won the gauntlet match on the pre-show. They ended up going to the pay-per-view, challenging the Shield for the tag team titles. And that was part of the reason I dislike this show, is that, especially towards the end, everything just felt rushed. You know, the Ziggler-Ambrose match was just kind of stuck in there. Really wasn't even that good of a match. They had a much better match the next night. At one point, I looked at the time. I didn't even know if they were going to do the tag match at all. I thought maybe it got bumped. But then they finally, you know, they got the guys in there. They were in there for a few minutes. Really wasn't much of a match. For whatever reason, the time management on this show just felt off. Like at the end, they just kind of rushed things so they could get to the main event. AJ Lee retained her Divas title in the four-way over Natalya, Brie Bella, Naomi. Had the Divas stopwatch at 5 minutes 35 seconds. The beginning of the show. Let's talk about the beginning of the show really quick here, because the show opened with a Triple H promo. Like I said, glorified edition of Raw. I don't buy pay-per-views to listen to Triple H ramble on for 15 minutes at the beginning of the show. I expect that on Monday nights, not on pay-per-views. So they have him come out, he cuts a promo, which was very weird, because Triple H is obviously a heel. Most of this promo, he was positioned as a babyface. He was trying to position himself as fair. He was, you know, healing it up on Paul Heyman, who came out with Curtis Axel. The fans were cheering. You know, Heyman was basically on his way to death that night against Punk. He was trying to get out of the match. It didn't work. We ended up with an impromptu Intercontinental title match between Kofi Kingston and Curtis Axel, because they finally realized it's Night of Champions and the Intercontinental title isn't even on the line. So we had Kofi's pecs against Axel. Axel retains the title, so at least he has one win on this show. He used this finisher. I don't even know if he has a name for it. I don't like his finisher at all. I think it's way too similar to Dean Ambrose's kind of DDT driver. He ought to just keep the perfect plex. Right now they have him using the perfect plex as a setup move. Everybody kicks out of it. I don't like that. I think that they should just give that to him as a finisher. I know in 2013 a fisherman suplex is not exactly a devastating finishing maneuver, but I don't know. People still look fondly on that move from, you know, when his father used to use it, and I just think you just stick with what works. The move is over. You may as well use it. RVD beat Alberto Del Rio by DQ. Del Rio retains the world title. He was disqualified because he refused to let go of the armbar after Van Damme reached the ropes. Just a completely god-awful finish to a title match on pay. This is right up there with Mark Henry kicking Big Show in the balls at Survivor Series a couple of years ago and getting DQ'd. I mean, I know it's not the main event on the show, so they feel they can get away with that, but what a bullshit finish. I mean, that's part of the reason I think that pay-per-views are not doing nearly as well as they used to be. It's because people have come to expect bullshit finishes on pay-per-view, and they're not willing to spend money on it. It used to be where the pay-per-view was where the really exciting stuff would happen, or one feud would climax, there'd be a big shock, maybe another feud would start. You wouldn't get all these bullshit finishes in these title matches where, you know, this guy won't break by the count of five, and this guy low blows him, and the referee calls for the bell, when in other matches, the referee may well see a low blow and not call it. So it's that inconsistency that just, I think, has people going, eh, whatever. And they're kind of apathetic to the whole thing. So Van Dam did bust out a Van Terminator when the match was over, coast to coast. Michael Cole called it a Van Daminator, but by the next night on Raw, he had corrected himself. We had the handicap elimination match, Punk against Heyman and Axel. It was really two matches in one. Wasn't much of a handicap match, really, because it was Punk versus Axel. He beat Axel. Then he went after Heyman, chased him around. Heyman was wearing a jacket, so I'm sure underneath the jacket, Heyman was wearing padding. I don't know this, but he never took the jacket off, and Punk never ripped it off him. So what other reason would there be for him wearing it other than he had protection? Actually, he should have had some real protection. He should have brought a gun to the ring with him if he knew that he was going to be killed. You got to defend yourself. So in the end, Ryback is revealed as the new Paul Heyman guy, as I predicted. He put Punk through a table in the corner, pulled Heyman on top of him. Paul Heyman now has a win over CM Punk. This feud will continue. Throughout the night, this was what I found to be the most entertaining thing of the night. They had these polls. Okay, you had to go on WWE.com, or I don't think they did them in the app. I think it was on .com. Voting on who you thought was the best champion. So for the Divas title, who you thought was the best Divas champion, U.S. champion, IC champion, so on and so forth. Chris Jericho won the poll as the greatest Intercontinental champion of all time, I'm sure infuriating the Honky Tonk Man. Jericho won the title a record 9 times, so I have no problem with that. So the first kind of wonky poll came when they did the world title poll. Now, the options were very limited. There were a lot of names they left out. Again, it's just a dot-com gimmick. But the world title poll had, among other people in it, they had Booker T, Edge, Undertaker, and Ric Flair. I think they had somebody else. I don't remember. Booker T won the poll for greatest world heavyweight champion of all time over Edge, Taker, and Flair. So Booker T was part of the panel of analysts they had on the show here for Night of Champions, and when they went to him afterwards, even he was laughing at how preposterous it was that he would win a poll of greatest world champion over somebody like Ric Flair. It's just completely comical. So then they did a U.S. title poll, and they had, I think Rick Rude was in the poll, Ricky Steamboat, and Sting. Now, when I think of Sting, I don't think, wow, you know, Sting used to be a great United States champion. I think of Sting as a former NWA and WCW, and I guess TNA, World Heavyweight Champion. I don't associate him with the U.S. title. That right there tells you that he was probably in this poll for a reason. And you had to know, I mean, Sting, aside from Steamboat, Sting was the biggest name in this poll in terms of popularity and characters. He's probably even more popular than Steamboat. I predicted Sting would win, and he did. Sting was voted by the fans as the greatest U.S. champion of all time. They acknowledge it on commentary. I just think it's kind of odd that you would put him in that poll unless you wanted him to be in that poll. So then later on, they go to the WWE Championship. Who is the greatest WWE champion of all time? And the choices are, let me see if I can remember this here. The choices were Stone Cold Steve Austin, John Cena, Triple H, CM Punk, and Hulk Hogan. Now, obviously, a lot of names left out. Where's Shawn Michaels? Where's Bret Hart? Undertaker, who I guess was in the world title poll. Even Bruno Sammartino, you can make an argument that he should be in there, even though he wouldn't have won. In the end, as I predicted, Hulk Hogan won. Not only did Hogan win, he won in a landslide. 55%. Second place was Stone Cold Steve Austin with 16%, which, boy, I don't think Austin's wrestling ever again anyway, but if there was ever any way to kill a guy's leverage in terms of his drawing ability, I don't think that bodes too well that Steve Austin, who some people might say is the greatest champion in history in terms of his popularity, got 16% of the vote to Hulk Hogan's 55. I just looked at this and I said, okay, so we have a situation here where the two top names, or two of the top names in TNA, just won polls on WWE television, and oddly enough, both of their contracts are coming up for expiration very soon. And by the time the show was over, all I could think to myself was, on this show, Sting had more victories than Dolph Ziggler. That just seems wrong, but it's true. It's true. And they had one more poll, by the way. Greatest tag team champions of all time. Hart Foundation, Bulldogs, Road Warriors. Nope. DX. Shawn Michaels and Triple H. I don't even know how many months did those guys even hold the tag team titles? 3-4 months? I don't even remember them being champions. I know they were. I just have no memory of this at all. Who'd they even feud with? Legacy? Is that when they feuded with? I don't even know. Anyway, main event was Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton for the WWE Championship. Good match, even a very good match. I've seen the two of them have better. I thought even that match they had on Raw many months ago where Bryan got Orton to tap out in the Yes Lock, I thought that was probably a better match. So in the end, we have Daniel Bryan winning with his knee, and referee Scott Armstrong goes down, and for whatever reason, does a fast count, which the announcers do not acknowledge. They pretend like nothing ever happened, and the people at first didn't know what to think. I don't think they popped quite as big as you might expect them to, because they probably thought, okay, this is a bullshit finish. Triple H is going to come out, he's going to reverse it, or pull some shenanigans. He never did. Nobody ever came out. The fans started to get into it more and more when they realized that he may well have won the title for real this time, and he celebrated, and that's how they went off the air. A feel-good moment to a show that just wasn't very good. It just couldn't save the show, and when they went off the air, you just knew. You knew there was a pretty decent shot that by the time they went off the air the next night, that guy probably was not going to still be WWE champion, and if you thought that, you would be right. Monday Night Raw, the very next night from Cleveland, Ohio. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Here's some random Raw observations. Show open with Triple H stripping Daniel Bryan. Boy, they didn't waste any time. Stripping him of the WWE Championship. He said the title is now being held in abeyance, or a state of suspension, for those of you who had to look up what abeyance actually meant, as I did. 84 replays of Scott Armstrong counting normally and fast counting at the pay-per-view. They showed us, they gave us side-by-side comparisons of him, his normal cadence, and him doing the fast count. Scott Armstrong is brought down to the ring, and Triple H is asking him, you know, what do you have to say for yourself? And I think he said he made a mistake. And anyway, there's the point where Armstrong whispers something to Daniel Bryan. He whispers, oh, they got us. You know, they got us, Daniel. And Daniel Bryan has absolutely no idea what this guy is talking about. Triple H mentions that, you know, Shawn would not be proud of his actions. And in fact, Shawn Michaels is expected to be back on Raw sometime in the next several weeks, hence the name drop. Triple H says there may be a rematch, but he wants the belt. Daniel Bryan refuses to give it to him. Randy Orton comes out. Triple H fights with Bryan. He tries to get the belt away from him, and in this melee that ensues, Orton lays out Daniel Bryan with an RKO. So the poor bastard gets stripped of his title and stripped of his dignity. He gets left laying again at the end of this segment. At least at the end of the show, he would be standing tall, but things weren't looking too good here at the end of this opening segment for Daniel Bryan. So as of right now, there is no WWE champion. This all reminds me of when Kane and Undertaker got that double pin on Steve Austin, and Vince McMahon left with the belt. He announced on Raw the next night that the title was vacant and that they didn't even crown a new champion for another 2 months. That title was vacant for 2 months until the Survivor Series in 1998 when they did that deadly game tournament, which The Rock won when he turned heel and went corporate. And in one of the newsletters, I think it was the F4W newsletter this week, they reported that the scuttlebutt is that Randy Orton versus Daniel Bryan's rematch at the Battleground pay-per-view may be an Iron Man match, which I personally would not mind at all. I mean, Bryan Danielson in a 60-minute match, I say sign me up. And Orton, you know, Orton's no slouch either. I like that Iron Man match that he had with John Cena a few years ago. And, you know, if they do it, they could do a finish where it ends in a tie. Again, this is WWE, so even though there's been Iron Man matches in the past where it went to sudden death, eh, just ignore it. You could change the rules as you go along. So you have them wrestle for an hour. They're tied at however many falls apiece. And I would suggest doing a lot of falls. I still think one of the things that killed that Bret Shawn match back in 96, which I thought was, it was a really good match, but it was also very boring up until they got in the last, like, 5 or 10 minutes and things really picked up. And I think part of it is, you know, doing zero falls, it killed the match a little bit. I think if they would have done like 2 or 3 falls apiece, it would have added to the excitement. When Rock and Triple H had their Iron Man match at Judgment Day in 2000, I think the final score was like 6-5 or something like that. I thought that was a hell of an Iron Man match. I thought that was a hell of a lot more exciting than the Bret Shawn match from WrestleMania 12. So, you know, let them have a couple of falls each. And they're tied at the end. There is no overtime. And the title can stay vacant until the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view at the end of the month. You bring these guys back for one more singles match inside the cage. And you crown a new champion at that point. I don't know if that's the direction they're going in. That might be something that I would consider. But I think it would make sense. Especially if you have two pay-per-views in 1 month. You got to have some big draw for that Hell in a Cell show. Just having a Hell in a Cell match doesn't cut it anymore because they give you one every single year. It doesn't mean as much as it used to. If they're going to definitely crown a new champion, if they guarantee, no matter what, at that pay-per-view at the end of October, we will crown a new WWE champion, well, then you have something. So we'll see if they do the Iron Man match. It's just a rumor right now. Dolph Ziggler and Dean Ambrose had a rematch from Night of Champions. Dolph was over big time on Raw Monday night. Apparently he grew up not far from Cleveland. These two had a much, much better match than they did at the pay-per-view. This time Dolph won with the zigzag, so it looks like that feud is going to continue. No wonder people were demanding refunds for Night of Champions. You know, first Daniel Bryan gets stripped of the title, which renders the outcome of the main event meaningless. And then we get Ziggler versus Ambrose on free TV, and it's a much better match. I'd be pissed off, too, if I were those people. Every time Dolph Ziggler in a match does those 10 elbows now, he points to Jerry Lawler at the announce booth, which I think is funny. I mean, it's funny because he didn't die. Had he died last year, wouldn't be so funny. And on commentary, JBL referred to Ziggler as the heart stopper. Man, I wish I would have thought of that first. Fandango pinned R-Truth with his leg drop off the top rope. I don't think I've seen Fandango win a match clean with his move on Raw ever. I found this to be completely shocking. And then we got the segment with the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, who Stephanie McMahon had invited to Raw. She said that she had a business proposal for Dusty. That's what she tweeted over the weekend. So out came Dusty, who's lost a lot of weight. Apparently, from what I read, he's going to be having a knee replacement operation soon, and they told him that the more weight you lose, the better off you'll be. So he was looking pretty good. Very old, but he's almost 70. So what do you expect? So Dusty came out, perhaps cutting the last great promo of his career. Every promo could be the last great promo of his career. It's not like he's on TV from week to week anymore. I thought Dusty did a hell of a job. I thought this whole segment was great. This was my favorite segment on the entire show, aside from the ending. Dusty, I thought, you know, he stumbled and mumbled over his words at a few points, and he's got that southern drawl. Sometimes it's almost hard to understand what he's saying. But Dusty is freaking awesome. And I thought he was on his A game here. He looked like he barely missed a beat. I thought he was intense when Stephanie came out. And Stephanie, too. I thought Stephanie was awesome in this segment. This was, you know, like the complete opposite of that bullshit we saw 2 weeks ago with Stephanie and Big Show when she first said that, you know, Big Show's broke and you used to be my giant and the strip mall and, you know, all the bullshit coming out of her mouth. It was just spewing. This was the complete opposite. I thought the story they told here was great. Dusty was there to hear Stephanie's proposal. And Stephanie's proposal was, I am willing to give Cody Rhodes his job back. And Dusty thought, great, thanks. And he went to leave. And Stephanie said, well, wait, I'm putting the choice in your hands. Cody could get his job back, or Dustin, Goldust, can get his job back. We only have one open spot. So here she is putting Dusty, the father, in a very difficult position to have to choose between his two sons here. You know, Goldust was on Raw, looked very impressive even though he got beat by Randy Orton. Always looking for that one last run, right? Here's a situation where Goldust can get his job back, but only one person can get it. So do you give it to Cody or do you give it to Goldust? Now, I think I have a note here. Matt, one of our listeners, Matt DiNapoli, wrote, and he made a very interesting point that I wanted to bring up here. He thought maybe he was nitpicking, but I don't think it's nitpicking. He loved Dusty's delivery and the promo on Monday night like I did, but he thought the whole issue of him picking whether to give Cody or Dustin a job was silly. And the reason it was silly is because the whole purpose of Goldust being on Raw 2 weeks ago was so that he can help get his brother's job back. That's the whole point of this whole storyline. They're all trying to get Cody his job back. So why would it be such a difficult decision for Dusty to have to choose one over the other when Dustin, in theory, would be perfectly fine with Dusty giving Cody the position because that's what they're both interested in. So I thought that was a really good point that he made. But if you forget about that for a second, I like the basic story they told here. It's you're asking a parent to choose between two of his sons. I mean, that's almost an impossible choice to make. And Dusty ended up telling Stephanie, you know, I'm not going to make that choice. You can go to hell. And Stephanie said, okay, you first. Or she should have said, actually, that would have been a great comeback. I don't think she said that, but she should have said, okay, you first. Out came the Shield. And I love the fact that even after all this time, when the Shield comes out, especially if there's a legend in the ring, when their music hits, people react. They go crazy like, uh-oh, somebody's going to die. And out they came. Stephanie said, you know, she's going to call the Big Show out as well. The Big Show came out. And she said to the Big Show, knock him out. She wanted Big Show to knock out Dusty Rhodes. And here comes the Big Show with all the waterworks. He starts crying again. I admit, boy, the Big Show has been just completely emasculated in this story. He's out there crying every week. I mean, my God, this guy probably just sits at home watching Lifetime movies all day long. I mean, he's such a sentimental person. I didn't know how sensitive the guy was. He doesn't want to do it. You know, it's weird, too, because as much as I joke about that, and I think we're all kind of sick of seeing crying Big Show, this particular segment here, their use of Big Show in this segment was actually pitch perfect, I thought. You know, he's out there. Stephanie is saying, if you want to save your job, you got to knock out this legend. And Big Show has nothing but respect for Dusty. I mean, hell, the two of them, remember, at one time, they were both former members of the NWO. So they have that in common. And Big Show is just completely tortured by this. He doesn't want to knock out Dusty. I mean, the guy's almost 70 years old. He's a legend. So Stephanie says, okay, fine. The Shield is ready to just destroy Dusty. Big Show tells him, don't you lay a hand on him. And he apologizes. And he balls up his fist. He knocks out Dusty. Dusty can't take a bump at this point. So they did this awesome deal where instead of him having to fall down and possibly injuring himself, Big Show caught him, hugged him, gave him a bear hug, and very gently, slowly lowered him down to the mat. I thought the way they did this whole thing was freaking awesome. Stephanie came across as pure evil during this segment. The Big Show built up even more sympathy for everything he's going through. I thought this was great. And I said at the end of the segment, I tweeted it out, I have a way out of this storyline that they're doing with Big Show, because I still think the story is so stupid. Yeah, he's broke, he's got a, you know, without this job, he's nothing. He's going to be destitute on the street somewhere. It's just completely ludicrous. So I have a way out of this god-awful storyline here. If I were booking this, I'd have the Big Show show up on Raw next Monday with a winning Powerball ticket in his hand and just beat the shit out of everybody. Just destroy everybody and everything in his path. Big Show wins Powerball, he's set for life, and that's it. Things go back to normal. No more of this broken, destitute BS. He hits the lottery and goes back to being the Big Show. That's the only way out of this thing. Otherwise, we're going to have many more months of this. I don't know how much more of crying Big Show I can take. But at least for this one segment on Monday, I thought it worked. Divas Stopwatch was 2 minutes and 57 seconds on this show. We had Brie Bella and the Funkadactyls beating the team of Alicia Fox, Oksana, and Layla. On commentary, AJ Lee, along with Natalya. AJ, not quite as awesome on commentary this week. Still very good, but half the time was Natalya talking. We couldn't hear her. Her headset didn't work. So obviously they're building to a singles match, I guess, between AJ and Natalya. Rob Van Dam and Damian Sandow. I'll give you one guess as to how this match ended. If you guess 5-star frog splash, well, you win. You don't win anything, but congratulations, because everybody in the world knew how this match was going to end. Damian Sandow's losing streak continues. Apparently, he did win a match at the main event tapings. I had a few people tweet that to me. Who gives a shit? Main event doesn't count. Superstars doesn't count. It's Raw, it's SmackDown. That's it. And Damian Sandow, I can't even remember the last time he won a match on either of the two main shows. So he continues to lose. I guess that's their way of making it so that when he cashes in Money in the Bank, will least expect it, and it'll be shocking if he wins. I still think that when Sandow cashes in, he's going to cash in unsuccessfully. People have to start losing. I think John Cena is still the only person who has ever unsuccessfully cashed in Money in the Bank. I mean, if everybody just wins, it takes the drama out of the whole thing. You've got to have one or two people lose to plant the seeds of doubt, so it's not an automatic guarantee that if you win the briefcase, you're going to win the title. Plus, and I know they do this with most of the Money in the Bank winners, but with Sandow, it's been, I mean, just complete and utter destruction of this guy since he won. This guy loses every match he's in, and you're going to put the world title on him? I mean, we already know the world title doesn't mean shit, but you're going to make that world title mean less than shit? There's actually a level less than shit. Sub-shit. And that's what the title's going to mean if you put the belt on a guy who can't win a match to save his life. So the way they're booking him, I don't think Sandow's going to win, and I don't think he should. I think when he cashes in, you know, they still kind of play him up for comedy. Have him come in all cocky when the champion is vulnerable, and they'll probably have to do it at some point when Del Rio loses, because I just don't see him cashing in on another heel. He comes in all cocky and arrogant, tries to win, gets rolled up or something and pinned. I could easily see that happening. Easily. There was a segment backstage where Triple H was talking to the referee who screwed Randy Orton out of the title at the pay-per-view, Scott Armstrong. And basically, he fired him. He said, I gotta let you go, but don't worry, I'm gonna take care of you. He mentioned a severance package in here somewhere. And basically, in storyline, you know, I'm gonna take care of you equals keep your mouth shut, don't squeal that I told you to fast count last night, which I assume is the story that will come out eventually, is that Triple H put Scott Armstrong up to this, or somebody in the McMahon family told Scott Armstrong, listen, if Orton's in trouble and if Orton's going to lose, I don't want to make it so obvious that I come out and interfere. So you count his shoulders down, but you count fast. So we have a built-in excuse to make it seem like, you know, Daniel Bryan won the title in an unnatural way. Whatever. I assume that's the story here. There were people, and I tend to agree with this, who thought that a lot of the comments Triple H made in this segment with Scott Armstrong was kind of a wink and a nod to what may have happened in real life with Vince McMahon and Jim Ross. You know, he mentioned a severance package, and, you know, you've worked for the company for 20 years, which he hasn't. In fact, Scott Armstrong, I think, only first came over to WWE and started refereeing in 2006. How the hell do you get 20 years off 2006? Jim Ross, though, Jim Ross has been with the company for 20 years. So these may have been some very veiled comments at JR. There's a lot of people who think that part of the reason, if not the reason, Jim Ross has not said one bad word about either WWE or just not one bad word about how and why he left, which was clearly not his choosing, is because he's probably got a sweet deal and he's not allowed to say anything bad about the company. And if that's the case, then I don't blame him. You know, he wants to take care of his family. He wants to get, you know, a nice big paycheck maybe on his way out the door. Fine. By the way, no mention at all of Jim Ross on this show. I thought maybe there'd be, maybe not a video, but an acknowledgement on commentary, like a quick shot of the announcer saying, oh, we would just want to wish congratulations to Jim Ross on his retirement. And then they make a, you know, a joke at his expense and they move on. Nothing. Not one mention of the retirement or anything at all. This was just something they wanted this swept under the rug and done and over with. They don't even want to acknowledge it on television. I think that speaks volumes right there about what bullshit that whole situation was. Then we have Randy Orton and The Miz. And ordinarily, I would not classify The Miz, his segment, as my favorite on Raw each week. But this week, it was way up there. Miz was in his hometown of Cleveland, so he was very over with the crowd, which is a rare thing these days. His parents were at ringside. Mr. and Mrs. Miz were at ringside. He went over to them. He was hugging them. And we got to see Miz's dad on TV for the very first time. He did not look like anything I ever would have imagined when it came to what the Miz's dad looks like. It just was mind-boggling to me. The first I thought, okay, he has to be adopted. He just has to be. I don't think he is, but that was my first thought. And basically, they showed the Miz's parents because they were going to be playing a role in this match. Randy Orton, who had been chastised backstage earlier in the night by Stephanie and Triple H as not being aggressive enough. What happened to the Viper who, you know, DDT'd me back in the day and all this other stuff. So Randy Orton was going to come out and show a mean streak. So he went out there, and he was killing The Miz. He was just destroying this poor guy right in front of his parents. And for her, you know, for her part, to her credit, Miz's mom was awesome. Miz's mom was, you know, genuinely disturbed by what she was seeing. She was emotional. She was crying. as any mother probably in that situation would feel the same way if she's seeing her son utterly destroyed right in front of her eyes. Reminded me of the angle they did on SmackDown about a decade ago with Brock Lesnar and Zach Gowen. Zach Gowen, the one-legged wrestler, he was just a novelty in WWE. He didn't last that long. Brock absolutely destroyed this guy. I mean, if you think Randy Orton destroying Miz on this show was brutal, it really wasn't that brutal. There was no blood or anything. You got to go back and find the video online of Brock Lesnar's destruction of Zach Gowen in front of his mom, Zach's mom at ringside. His mother wasn't crying, but she was, you know, yelling at Lesnar, "Leave my son alone, you leave him alone." And Lesnar's just like, "Yeah, fuck off, lady." And he just beats the shit out of Zach Gowen. His mom jumped over the barricade to, like, shield her son. It was great stuff. So Miz's mom was acting like any mother would. And then you look at Miz's father, and I'm not sure that his expression changed from the first time they showed him until the end of the segment. I don't think his expression changed at all. I just love how his father looked completely nonplussed by Orton killing his son right in front of him. See? Even his own dad hates him. I'm not the only one. His own father hates his guts. Actually, you know who his dad reminded me of? I swear to God, Miz's father, if you look at him facially, he reminded me of Milton from Office Space. If Milton from Office Space had long hair, like shoulder-length long hair like Miz's dad does, it's exactly who he reminded me of. Just staring out into space. I mean, you look at the guy, he looks like he could be a roadie for 3MB. I think Miz's father was one of the best parts of Raw Monday Night. He became a star. He's a bigger star than his son. I would much rather see Mr. Miz, kind of like I'd rather see Mr. Cena, actually. John Cena's dad's pretty awesome, too. I'd rather see him on the show than his son. And I think this would be a great gimmick for him, too. This gimmick where he wants to be in the corner of anybody but his son. Because, obviously, he doesn't give a shit if The Miz gets his ass kicked or not. Probably because he saw The Miz getting his ass kicked all the time as a kid, so he's looking at this going, I'm used to it. But you could have him on TV every week. One week he's like a roadie for 3MB. Another week he could be somebody in somebody else's corner doing something else. Or you can have these like backstage segments where as somebody's being interviewed or there's a conversation going on, you see Miz's dad in the background just staring at the camera with that blank look on his face, just staring off into the distance. Like he's photobombing all of these shots. It could be like a big brawl going on backstage, and in the background, like Waldo, if you can fucking pick him out, there's Miz's dad, just staring. I think that'd be a tremendous gimmick. They did that Just Joe gimmick all those years ago. That guy would just be eavesdropping on everybody in the locker room and kind of stirring the pot, and they'd ask him, "Who are you? What's your name?" And he'd be like, "Oh, I'm just Joe." If they could do that gimmick, let's get Miz's dad on TV. They ended up doing an injury angle with Miz where Orton, I think, put his head in a chair and stomped on it, and they said that Miz was taken to the hospital with a damaged thorax. So I don't know if Miz is going to be off TV for a while. Sometimes they do injury angles and they're back on TV 2 weeks later. I question doing two injury angles on the same show. You know, after they did the deal with Dusty Rhodes earlier, they carried him out on a gurney into an ambulance. They took him to the hospital. So this is the second injury angle on the same show, which I think, you know, when you do multiple injury angles like that on the same show, I feel like one negates the impact of the other. So I don't know that I would necessarily be doing multiple ones. You just do one. Do one big injury angle on the show, and it just feels more special and it feels more impactful than if you do two or three. You know, you do another one an hour later. We had Ryback roll Paul Heyman out on stage in a wheelchair. Heyman spoke lovingly of his new Heyman guy who saved his life the night before. Heyman was looking much healthier than he has in weeks. It looks like he actually got a good night's sleep. He was clean-shaven for the first time in many weeks. Called himself the best in the world because he beat CM Punk the night before. He said he owed everything. He owed his life to Ryback. And so Ryback got on the microphone, called CM Punk a bully, which of course is ironic because Ryback is probably the biggest bully on the roster, but he doesn't like bullies. And he says he can't stand them. He got down on his knee and lovingly gazed at Paul Heyman, and he told Paul, "You never have to worry again about CM Punk." And Paul Heyman had this look, like he had this twinkle in his eye as he looked at Ryback, and then He leaned over in his wheelchair and he gave Ryback a kiss on the cheek before Ryback rolled him to the back. There's a fanfic I don't think anybody ever wanted to see. Three-team elimination tag team match to determine the number one contenders to the Shield's tag team titles. The Usos are once again number one contenders to the titles. They beat the Real Americans and Tons of Funk. There was a spot in this match where Antonio Cesaro did his giant swing. The only reason I knew this is because when they came back from commercial break, they showed it to us in that little window in the corner on the fucking app. So they wasted the giant swing, which was one of the best moments on Raw a few weeks ago when he did it to Santino. And I thought that maybe that would become like his big thing. Like people would look forward to seeing that on TV each week. And they wasted it on the frickin' app. So I actually went on the app. Okay, they got me. So I went on the app and I said, I got to see this giant swing because they were talking on commentary. Oh, he did like 27 rotations. That's a new record for him. Even though I'm pretty sure on the indies he did a lot more than that. So I go on the app and I look it up. And I see the giant swing, right? He starts doing it. And the problem is this. He started doing it during the commercial. And in the middle of the giant swing, like he's doing it back and forth, he's twirling him around, they cut away because they were going back live on the air. So even in the frickin' app, you couldn't see the giant swing. You had to like piece the two parts together. You had to piece together the part that you saw on the app with, I guess, the piece that you saw on TV when they came back from commercial. This whole thing was fucked. Just do it on the show. Why are you wasting this shit on the app? Man, what can I say? I'm a big fan of the giant swing. Main event was Daniel Bryan against Roman Reigns. And this was, I think this was Roman Reigns' first really big singles match on TV. Normally, it's Daniel Bryan against Ambrose, Daniel Bryan against Seth Rollins. The two of them work tremendously well together. So this was going to be a real test for Roman Reigns, and he couldn't be in there with a better opponent. They went very long. This match went, I don't know when this match went. It went probably almost 20 minutes, a good 15, 20 minutes. It was actually a very good match. I thought the crowd was into it. I thought, you know, Bryan obviously, you know, made Reigns look good. Reigns held his own. Reigns is not a bad wrestler at all, which is why I think Roman Reigns is going to be an even bigger star once the Shield actually does break up. Dean Ambrose ought to be a heel for the rest of his life until they put him in the ground. He was born to be a villain. But I think Seth Rollins can be a big babyface. I think Roman Reigns is going to be the biggest breakout star in that group, certainly as a babyface. I think he's got Batista written all over him in that I think the split will happen very similarly to the way it happened with Batista and Evolution, where, you know, things, maybe he's being barked at, you know, they're barking orders at him and he doesn't like it, and they do this slow burn. Eventually he breaks away from the Shield, breaks away from the administration, and people just take to him because he's got the look. You know, he just looks the part, and he's not a bad wrestler, especially for a big guy. He's a good big guy wrestler. He's not in there doing all the technical crap that Daniel Bryan would do, but he doesn't have to. That's not his role. I still maintain, I said it before, I'll say it again, he's going to be, I think, the biggest breakout star in that group when that time comes. Shield started getting involved at the end. Ambrose tried to interfere. Daniel Bryan, I have to mention this, at one point, he gave one of these low drop kicks to Seth Rollins on the outside. He kind of drop kicked him through the ropes, and I thought he murdered him. I thought he absolutely murdered Seth Rollins. Rollins just shot backwards as quickly as you could possibly fall backwards, and he struck his head on the announce desk. I thought he was dead. I mean, that looked just absolutely awful for Rollins. Thankfully, I think he's okay. I haven't heard that he's concussed or anything like that. Bryan went for the win. Randy Orton, who was at ringside, just staring. He wasn't doing commentary or anything like that. He got involved. Disqualification. So they're all ganging up on Daniel Bryan. You know, here we go again. Daniel Bryan being beaten up. 3-on-1, 4-on-1. And Orton is about to kill him. All of a sudden, the babyfaces all run out. The entire babyface portion of the roster, they come sprinting down to the ring. The Usos and Zack Ryder and Kofi Kingston and Rob Van Dam, all these guys. They run to primetime players. They all run down to the ring. Randy Orton was smart. Randy Orton bailed, like the coward that he is. The Shield stayed. The Shield tried to hold their own. They got their asses kicked, although Kofi Kingston was the one lone babyface who did eat a spear from Roman Reigns. So Kofi got laid out. But otherwise, The Shield got their asses kicked. They cleared the ring. Daniel Bryan ended up giving Seth Rollins his, well, I guess they're not calling it this anymore, but I still like the name, the move that beat John Cena, which is now also the move that beat Randy Orton. He used that knee on Seth Rollins, who sold it like a champ. Thankfully, this time, the production people actually filmed it and didn't film the crowd when he gave Rollins the knee. And the show ended with all the babyfaces hoisting Daniel Bryan up on their shoulders. Everybody in the building, all the fans were chanting yes. They went to a wide shot of the crowd. These people were going absolutely apeshit. And I know it has not necessarily been reflected in terms of maybe TV ratings. And you know, we'll see when that Night of Champions buy rate comes in. The SummerSlam buy rate came in this week, and it really was not a good number. It was less than last year. So time will tell from a business perspective how Daniel Bryan is doing. But, you know, you look at these reactions that he gets on television every single week, it goes well beyond people just liking, you know, the yes chant. It's fun to do the yes chant. These people love Daniel Bryan, and I haven't seen a babyface over like this in a long-ass time. There was one person, I think, who was actually at the building on Monday night, who compared the reaction that Bryan gets to a reaction that Hulk Hogan or Steve Austin would get back in the day. And honestly, you know what? It's probably the closest thing we have right now. I mean, John Cena gets a reaction when he comes out, but it's that mixed reaction where people love to just go, you know, let's go Cena, Cena sucks, half the crowd boos him. Actually, more than half the crowd boos him. But in terms of just a pure babyface response, this response out of love to a top babyface in the company, it may well be that long since we've seen that, you know, to a top babyface. I can't think of anybody else who's gotten reactions like this, not even CM Punk, you know, when he was at his most popular. So I thought that closing scene of Raw Monday Night was great. It was great not to see Bryan get laid out again and to see all the babyfaces finally stand up to the administration, grow a set of balls, run out there, clean house on the Shield, and with Bryan up on their shoulders, again, it was like Bret Hart back at WrestleMania 10 when all the baby faces came out, hoisted him up. It was a great closing shot. I thought Raw ended very strong on Monday night. And it's a very rare thing when you see Zack Ryder and Justin Gabriel in the ring at the end of Raw with fans going crazy. I sure as hell didn't see that coming. So Raw this Monday is in Chicago. CM Punk will be back in his hometown on the show as hurt as he may be. I think Raw this week is going to be real fun. And it's going to be real fun because of the Chicago fans. I mean, they're awesome. Chicago fans may be the best fans in the country. I live in New York. The New York crowds can be fun. But Chicago, I'm expecting a fun show this Monday. I also want to mention this before we move on here, because I know many of you have emailed me about this. We now know when tickets for WrestleMania 30 are going on sale. That date is Saturday, November 16th at 11 a.m. Eastern. Tickets will officially go on sale for WrestleMania on that day. Prices range from as low as $25 to as much as $2,000 per ticket for the first four rows. So if your last name is Trump, you can sit in the first four rows. Otherwise, the paupers like the rest of us, $25, I think up to about $850 is the main range. Again, unless you want those really front row up close seats. So start saving up, people. November 16th, that's the on sale date for those of you who have asked. NXT this week, I believe, was the last taping of the batch that they did many weeks ago. I think they just did new NXT tapings last week. I gave some spoilers. Those start airing, I believe, this Wednesday. Again, NXT now is free on Hulu. For those of you who don't know, you used to have to pay $7.99, I think it was, for a Hulu subscription to the WWE channel. I think you still have to pay for the other stuff, but you have no excuse not to watch NXT now. If you don't live internationally where it airs on TV, and you're here like I am in the U.S. stateside, you can go on Hulu.com and watch the entire show for free, and it is well worth your time. NXT this past week, Sami Zayn beat Curt Hawkins with a boot to the face and a tornado DDT. Curt Hawkins, I have not seen a Curt Hawkins match this long, I don't think, in my entire life. And Curt Hawkins was giving off a major AJ Styles vibe to me here, in terms of the way he looked. He looked just like him, right down to the gloves that AJ wears on his hands. Plus, I think he even busted out a Pele kick during this match, so I'm not quite sure what was going on here, but Sami Zayn wins. Aiden English defeated Michael Q. Laurie I think they said his name was. It was actually QT Marshall from Ring of Honor, likely getting a tryout. And, you know, between this and R.D. Evans appearing on SmackDown a few weeks ago, getting his ass kicked by Ryback, and guys like Punk and Bryan and Cesaro and now Sami Zayn, there's been quite an ROH influence on WWE these past few years. It's very noticeable. But let's talk about Aiden English. Holy shit. This man is great. Every time I've seen him on NXT in the past, he's been used as nothing more than an enhancement guy. Just some jobber, usually in a tag team match. He gets his ass kicked. You know, nothing from nothing. But they finally gave him a gimmick, and boy, he hit it out of the park on this show. He looks like something straight out of the 19th century. He claims he is an artiste and sounds like he's acting in some old English theater production when he speaks. He demands that they shine a spotlight on him on the stage, and then he proceeds to sing all the way down the ramp into the ring with piano music playing in the background. So think Mankind's original exit theme song. They had the piano playing. I was completely engaged in this guy's entrance, and the crowd applauded him when he was done, even though he's supposed to be a heel. Alex Riley, I thought, had a great line on commentary where he said, "If this guy can wrestle a lick, he's my favorite one here." And it was great because I was thinking the exact same thing as soon as he said it. So after he got the pin, he demanded the spotlight be placed back on him and sang one more time, to which the crowd applauded even louder than they did earlier. I thought that was awesome. I was all ready to proclaim this guy my new favorite on NXT, but then came Tyler Breeze in the main event, and, well, we'll get to that in a second. Backstage, NXT champion Bo Dallas on the phone, telling somebody not to stop Bo leaving. When Renee Young interrupts, he says he was talking to somebody on his new fan hotline. I hope it turns out to be more successful than the old Hulk Hogan hotline. He says he has a plan to determine who the number one contender should be for his title, but we have to wait until next week to find out what it is. Also next week, we are told that the COO of WWE, Triple H, will be on NXT to make a major announcement. And if you listen to Sound Off 292 last week, you already know what that announcement is. There is also going to be a tag team turmoil match. Didn't we just see one of those? So we're getting another one. To determine the number one contenders for the NXT tag team titles. Main event was a giant 8-man tag team match pitting Corey Graves, Adrian Neville, that hippie freak CJ Parker, and Xavier Woods against The Ascension, Leo Kruger, and yes, Tyler Breeze, the male model who takes selfies of himself and doesn't like to be hit in the face, was the most over person in this match. It was mostly Conor O'Brien, Rick Victor, and Leo Kruger doing all the work. Breeze absolutely did not want to be tagged in. He was practically hiding in the corner. The fans started chanting, "We want Breeze." Finally, Xavier Woods was in trouble, and Breeze tagged himself in. The place exploded. He threw one punch. That's it, just one punch. Xavier Woods then retaliated, hit him back, and Breeze had seen enough at that point. He quickly tagged back out. Everybody laughed. The crowd then chanted, "That was awesome." And, you know, we talk a lot about how bastardized that chant is, because it seems like every week, every other match, there's a "this is awesome," "that was awesome" chant or whatever. Never has there been a more appropriate part of a match to chant "that was awesome" than there. Because it was. It was quite awesome. You know, Joseph Park used to be my favorite character in all of wrestling. Well, not anymore. Tyler Breeze has supplanted him as my new favorite. Breeze pulled the same stunt later in the match when CJ Parker was in trouble, only this time all the other heels jumped off the apron and bailed on him, just like that bastard Sid did to Hulk Hogan on Saturday night's main event back in the day. They left the dude high and dry. That left Tyler Breeze all alone in the ring to get his ass kicked. CJ Parker knocked him down with an open hand thrust. Woods nailed his Lost in the Woods move. Corey Graves chop blocked his leg, left him laying. Adrian Neville climbed to the top for the Red Arrow corkscrew splash, got the pin, babyfaces win. They all posed for a group shot over Breeze's dead body in the middle of the ring. They mocked him. It really was a nothing show, if you look at it this week. Not really much to NXT. It was really saved only by the Aiden English debut, or re-debut, I guess you could call it, and the awesomeness of Tyler Breeze in the main event. So, two characters that absolutely will never be world champions, at least not with these gimmicks, but can definitely have a long-term spot on the main roster as entertaining mid-card acts. I mean, Santino has made a career out of it. I see no reason that these guys can't do the same or better. They're much better wrestlers than Santino is. I want to say thank you before I forget to all the people who have checked out my Bob Holly book review on our official YouTube channel. You can go to youtube.com and type in The Solemn Monster, all one word. That is our official channel. You can subscribe to us there. A lot of people have checked it out, got a lot of good feedback off of it, including from Bob himself, which I appreciate. So if you haven't checked that out yet, do go on YouTube. The Solemn Monster, all one word, is my official name on there. You could subscribe. Check out the Hardcore Truth book review. It's about 45 minutes long, pretty thorough, and a very good book. And he gets into some juicy stuff in there. I left some stuff out because I want people to read the book for themselves and hear some of the other stories. But I just wanted to say thank you for all the people who left some good feedback on that. And now it's time to look at the state of TNA wrestling. I play that sound effect because it feels like there's drama going on with this company every week. So I figured, let's just put everything together, put all the rumors, all the stories, the people who are no longer with the company, the people who have contracts coming up, everything's going on all at once. Let's put everything together and look at the state of Impact Wrestling. We'll start with Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan's TNA contract is reportedly set to expire on October 1st. So a little more than a week from now. You know, and he really is the smartest man in wrestling. I waffle back and forth between him and Kevin Nash a lot, but Hulk Hogan truly is the master. I don't know if he was just that smart or if Dixie was just that dumb to sign him to a deal that expires only a few weeks before their biggest pay-per-view of the year. I mean, you know, Hogan is the face of that company. He's the GM. And to think that he could walk 3 weeks before Bound for Glory is quite the mess they've gotten themselves into. You know, does Hogan walk or does he stay? I don't know. Part of me thinks if I'm Hulk Hogan and I'm making a ton of money, I've got my buddy Eric Bischoff in the driver's seat, creatively anyway, with Bruce Pritchard out of the picture. I'm on TV every week. I don't have to take a bump. And I've still got the power to make all those outside deals like he did with the WWE 2K14 video game and not have to cut TNA in on any of it. You know what? Why leave? It's a pretty sweet deal. It's an easy paycheck. But TNA is not WWE. In TNA, you're not going to have the big crowds. You don't have an event like WrestleMania. I don't give a shit how hard they try to build up Bound for Glory. You know, when RVD left TNA and went back to WWE, he said it was like he was reborn. People suddenly noticed him again. They realized he was alive. That would be the only reason I see for Hulk Hogan to leave. If he thinks he could get back into WWE and maybe get one more big WrestleMania payoff. But, you know, I don't think he can wrestle, so I'm not even sure what he would do there other than make an appearance and maybe throw some punches. From a TNA perspective, you got to let him go. I don't know that they will, but you have to. If you're having the kind of money issues they're supposedly having to where they can't even pay their own employees on time, then you know what? It's time to cut the fat. I saw an item in the latest Observer newsletter this week. They still have production people who have not been paid. One person quit. Others have talked about quitting. I guess their wives are pushing them to because they don't have a freaking paycheck coming in. You know, this is not ECW at the end where all those guys had all this faith and they were so loyal, so fiercely loyal to Paul Heyman. All those guys that still to this day have not been paid by Paul Heyman. But they stuck around for the end of ECW because they believed that much in the product and they were that loyal to Paul. Believe me, there are very few people who are that loyal to Dixie Carter the way that those guys were loyal to Paul Heyman back in the day. Especially if we're talking about production people. We're not even talking about wrestlers here. So I'm not saying getting rid of Hulk Hogan would change all of that, but it helps. You can get rid of little people like SoCal Val and Jesse Sorensen in little contracts like that. I'm sure whatever Hulk Hogan's making, it completely dwarfs what all of those people put together were probably making. The guys, he's not moving the needle for him. So you may as well cut bait. Sting's contract is also expiring at the end of the year. Every year, you know, he talks about it in interviews. Dixie talks about it. One more year, they give him one more contract. Well, his contract is going to come up at the end of the year. Dixie's always bringing him back. And every year we go through the same routine of, is Sting coming to WWE? Is he wrestling The Undertaker at WrestleMania? The only thing guaranteed about WrestleMania every single year, other than the streak, is the talk of Sting wrestling The Undertaker. He's now 55 years old. Undertaker, I believe, is 48. Yet, somehow, Sting looks younger than him, and he actually moves around like he's younger, too. He's got a sweet deal over in TNA. He's their franchise player. He's been with them since 2006. He's been as loyal to them as he was to WCW back in the day. He was their first Hall of Fame inductee. But he's done everything there is to do in TNA. They did that stipulation where he can never again have another title shot, which is good. He shouldn't be holding their title anymore. So what else is there for him to do? I guess if Hogan left, you could always slot Sting back in as the GM, which I think he used to be. You could do that, you know, but I don't know. I mean, he could see the writing on the wall and say, hey, you know what? It's been sweet, but peace out. And go make a deal with WWE. Book a program with him and Undertaker for WrestleMania in New Orleans next year. Put him in the Hall of Fame. Do a DVD of his career, which they were actually going to do years ago. And it was actually on the schedule. I know this because they announced the freaking thing. And then I guess somebody filled in Vince McMahon that he was still in TNA and they nixed it. You know, time is not on Sting's side if he wants to make the deal. I know we say this every year, but each year that passes, it becomes more and more true. And you know what? Of the two, Hogan or Sting, if I'm WWE and I could get either one of those guys, I go with Sting. Without question. Without hesitation, I go with Sting. Hands down. He's got the appeal of being somebody who was never in WWE before, but people know who he is. Okay, he could actually wrestle a big match on pay-per-view. I don't know how good it's going to be, but the fact that he could actually wrestle a match is more than you can say for Hogan. Hogan's body is physically shot. His back, you know, he can't do it. Hogan's already in the WWE Hall of Fame. Sting isn't. They can make a big deal out of his induction. Hogan's already had a shitload of DVDs. Sting hasn't. There's more money to be made off Sting. Plus, I just can't see WWE signing two guys at the same time who are both 60 years old, or close to 60 years old. One or the other, but not both. AJ Styles, it's been documented here on this show, he signed a contract extension that will keep him in TNA through the end of the year. In the meantime, he's still negotiating a new deal to stay with the company, but apparently money is the holdup. Money will determine whether or not AJ stays or goes. He feels he's been there from the beginning, he's been loyal, he's one of their best performers, all of which is true. He feels he deserves better. He probably does. And now he is. He's finally being pushed as the top guy in the company again for the first time in a couple of years. If TNA can't pony up the money he's looking for, he could very well be on his way out of the company also. And he's their top babyface. He's probably winning their world title at Bound for Glory. It would be a disaster for that company if they lost AJ Styles. Mickie James, who is just, you know, was one of the best characters that show had ever since she turned heel. I loved her heel shtick. She dropped the Knockouts title to ODB on Impact this past Thursday, largely because her contract was expiring. She is now a free agent. And TNA is trying to negotiate a new deal with her. They presented her with a new deal already. She turned them down. Supposedly, she's interested in going back to WWE. You know, and TNA's Knockouts division has already been gutted. It used to be one of the strong points of TNA. The X division used to be back in the day. At one point, the Knockouts division, I mean, the Knockout segments on Impact, once upon a time, would get the highest ratings of the entire show. Those days are over, but it's amazing to think they had Gail Kim, Awesome Kong doing their thing at the top of the division. They had the Beautiful People. SoCal Val never wrestled. They had a couple of other women as well. And you look at the Knockouts division now, and it's just absolutely been, it's been gutted. It's not what it used to be. They cut Tara. Taryn Terrell got pregnant, which is why she's off TV. And now they lose one of their best female performers. If they lose Gail Kim at some point, you may as well just fold the whole division. There's no point in even keeping it active anymore. Mr. Anderson's deal with TNA is up. He's also negotiating with them for a new contract. They wrote him out of storylines with that injury angle they did 2 weeks ago with Bully Ray. It could be Doc all over again. Remember Doc? They had big plans for Doc as a babyface, breaking away from Aces and Eights, and then they let his contract expire. This is a bad pattern with this company. I did a whole segment on my show months ago. I made a plea. I offered some free advice to the people in TNA and the people handling talent relations. Bruce Pritchard, whoever it was at the time. I think he had just been let go, actually. And I said, you know, for those of you with iPhones, there's this wonderful little app called Reminders. And if you don't have an iPhone, I'm sure Android has an equivalent. But in iOS, there's Reminders, which allows you to set a reminder for anything that you want. So I think that if the people in TNA would set reminders on their phone for every talent contract, it's not like they have that many guys left on the roster anyway, you set a reminder for each guy, and 3 months before their contract comes due, the little fucking thing starts beeping, and you know, okay, I got to start talking to this guy. Let's start negotiating a new deal. It's so simple. I feel like if they did that, they could probably avoid all of these issues. You know how many contracts came due, supposedly, that they didn't realize until the last minute, or they neglected it, and now they're like a week away or a month away, and they can't reach a deal in time, and the guy walks. Doc is somebody who was going to play an instrumental role. You know, it wouldn't shock me if what we saw with Anderson, if that was going to be Doc. Doc probably would have been the guy to break away, not Anderson. I almost feel like they did it with Anderson out of desperation because they had to fill that spot with somebody else. Who are you going to do it with? You're going to do it with Garrett Bischoff? You're going to do it with Wes Briscoe? Of course not. Anderson was the only guy that made sense. So now it may be Doc all over again with him if they can't reach a new deal. They pushed Anderson as the babyface, breaking away, and now he may be gone too. Kurt Angle? Who knows what his future holds? He's supposed to be inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame in a month as part of Bound for Glory. He's out of rehab now, but has not been back on TV. My assumption is that he'll be back on TV in the next few weeks, maybe even at the next live set of tapings this week. They did briefly mention him on TV on Thursday, so I assume he is going to still be there for the induction, but I mean, who the hell knows? You know, there's rumors now that TNA is going to be ending their road tapings and doing Impact from one central location starting next year, much like they did back when they had the Impact Zone. Impact Zone isn't even available anymore. I think they use it for something else now. The most likely destination, it sounds like, would be either Orlando again or Nashville, their home base, where they actually used to tape Impact at that old TNA asylum. All of this is being done in an effort to cut costs. They cannot afford these road tapings. It's bleeding them dry. So now they're going to have to go back to one place. They're going to have to take that step back and go back to doing things the way they used to. So it's tough times for TNA right now. You know, even Kevin Nash, good old Lucky Sperm Nash over there, who worked for the company for a number of years, he went off on them in a Twitter tirade this past week. He said, you know, TNA is out of cash, and being on the road, they no longer get to slide payments for up to 4 months to show a profit as they did at Universal. He said, Anderson and Mickey James are up. I bet you don't see them until after the first of the year. The dudes are playing on the deck. Enjoy the music. The old Titanic reference. That's never a good sign. And then he said, TNA had its highest ratings when Jeff Jarrett was in charge. Steady decline except for the Loaded Hogan live show. That would have been the January 4th, 2010 show that went head-to-head with Raw. Raw had the return of Bret Hart after 12 years, and Impact had the debut of Hulk Hogan. Seems like a lifetime ago. But yeah, it's been almost 4 years. And speaking of Jeff Jarrett, I found it interesting to read that Jarrett was backstage at the tapings 2 weeks ago working as a road agent. He's been with TNA doing other promotional type stuff. He's been with the company all along, but he has not been working backstage for them. He hasn't been on TV in forever. So I'm not sure if that's a sign of anything. Maybe we could see him back on TV at some point soon, but Jarrett has resurfaced. Wasn't really a fan of this week's Impact. I thought it was largely a pretty dull show. Definitely a step down from last week's awesome show. I thought Impact was great 2 weeks ago. And Thursday night, not so much. But that's what happens a lot of times when they tape that second show after the live version airs. Let's start with the AJ Styles, Dixie Carter segment at the end of the show. We're going to skip ahead to the end here. This whole show was built around AJ Styles confronting the president of TNA. I mentioned last week, I gave a spoiler alert, Dixie was going heel. I didn't know what she said. I just had read that she did a heel turn. So AJ Styles came to the ring for his big face-to-face. He started by saying that he had been in TNA since day one. All along, he just wanted to provide an alternative for the fans. And then one day, Dixie Carter's father, Bob, purchased her a wrestling company. He said she had no blood, no sweat, no wrestling experience. He blamed Dixie for breaking up the chemistry that made TNA what it was. He brought up Jerry Lynn and Low Key as guys who helped make the X Division. Styles said that she traded them for MMA stars and guys who got a 2-year paid vacation to do nothing and then left to go back to where they belong. That has to be a dig at Booker T. It has to be. I didn't really hear a lot of bad things about the WWE guys who went over to work for them, but Booker T, he's the one guy who you read about his stint in TNA, and it just sounds like that guy did not give a shit. I mean, he went to TNA, they pushed him hard at first, and then after a while, for whatever reason, it just seemed like the guy didn't care, he couldn't wait to get out of there, and the first chance he got, he went right back to WWE. So it would not shock me if that was a dig specifically at Booker T. He name-dropped Alex Shelley, Jay Lethal, which I still don't get either. You know, even Eric Bischoff supposedly loved the guy when he was in TNA. When I interviewed Jay Lethal on episode 187 a while back, there was no logical answer that he could give as far as why his time in TNA came to an end. I'm still puzzled by that decision. He mentioned Petey Williams also as guys who were gone because of Dixie's philosophy. Styles claimed that he has a chance to win the title, and despite what the internet says, he doesn't have a contract with TNA. Well, he does, but it's always fun to bash the internet, I guess. He said there's not a contracted wrestler in the locker room that has any respect for Dixie. He said he was going to win the title and make Carter get down on her knees. And I was a little worried where this promo was going at this point. He said he was going to make her pay. I thought that was actually maybe the funniest line of the whole thing. He's going to make her pay. In what, Monopoly money? She can't afford to pay to keep the lights on. So out came Dixie Carter. She said that she is accountable as the president of the company and that she owed AJ an apology. She said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I ever made you think you were really important in this company." So off to the races we were with heel Dixie. She said AJ was just a little bit better than average. And that's in any pond, which she repeated for emphasis. If you were having flashbacks to Stephanie McMahon running down Daniel Bryan a few weeks ago for only being 5'8", 190 pounds, and being a solid B+, believe me, you weren't the only one. Dixie said AJ was not the phenomenal one. He was more like the marginal one, since she could not remember the last 5-star match he was involved in because he's not close to what he used to be. She said if it wasn't for her daddy's money, Styles would still be living in a trailer. She went to leave. AJ had more to say, but she demanded his mic get cut, the lights be turned out because the show was over. Either that or they just didn't pay their bill. So they cut the lights, the fans booed, and that's how they went off the air. First, let me get the bad stuff out of the way because I didn't hate this segment, but it definitely had its flaws. Obviously, you watch this, and it immediately makes you think TNA is a second-rate company. Because they're copying off an angle that's happening right now in another company. They're not copying off something that was done a year ago, 5 years ago. They're copying an angle that is being done as we speak in another company. Okay, I see people online also saying, it's a ripoff of the CM Punk angle from 2 years ago. But you know what? I can't call it a ripoff of that because there's plenty of other examples of wrestlers cutting work shoot promos on TV, bashing their company or bashing the promoter. I mentioned Jeff Jarrett a little while ago. Jarrett did one himself when he came back to WWF in 97. He walked out on Raw one day wearing a beige suit, wet in the ring, and he cut a promo on Vince McMahon. Lots of wrestlers have done that, not just CM Punk. CM Punk wasn't the first. But people look at this and they perceive it as, oh, there's TNA copying off WWE again. And that's not even what bothered me the most. What bothered me the most about this is that you have AJ Styles. Okay, AJ Styles is the top babyface in TNA. Out there saying that TNA used to be so much better than it is today. How they used to be original. They used to be a real alternative. And he rattled off names of a bunch of talented guys who aren't with the company anymore. but probably should be, in all honesty. And then you have the owner out there calling her top babyface mediocre and saying that she can't remember the last time he had a great match. This whole promo just hit too close to home. He's out there ripping Dixie for being inept and clueless, and it's all true. And if it was going to lead to Dixie, let's say, legitimately being removed from power in favor of somebody who might actually be able to turn things around and might have a clue as far as what they're doing, I'd say, okay, fine. If that's the end game here, then that's great. But that's not going to happen. Dixie's not going anywhere. She's still going to be the president. So all you're doing is pointing out how weak the leader of your company is and how she ruined what made TNA so great to all these diehard TNA fans. I just don't see how it benefits anybody to be saying shit like that on TV. Is that supposed to be edgy? Is that what passes for edgy these days? It's like when AJ did that first promo and people flipped out because he made reference to CM Punk when he made that best in the world comment. And everybody was like, oh, shots fired, you know, this is awesome. And they all made a mess in their pants over it. And it's like, that promo sucked. He came off terribly in that promo. But mention the other company or their top star, and all of a sudden, oh, it's edgy and cool. No, it's not. It makes you look lame and desperate. So the substance of what they said, I thought, was really stupid. Substance aside, if you take away the actual content, which is kind of important, as far as Dixie Carter as a heel goes, I'm not sold, but I'm willing to give it a chance. You know, she wasn't great, but it's just one promo. We need to see a few more weeks of heel Dixie, I think, before saying that she sucks. I thought she showed some great fire. It's just that it really felt forced to me. You know, I think her voice started cracking at one point. You know, maybe she'll grow into it the way Stephanie did. Stephanie McMahon was also portrayed as this lovable, quiet female personality on TV when she was with Test. And then they turned her heel, and she grew into the role. She got better. And look at her now. When she shrieks on TV, her voice sounds like nails on a chalkboard, but she came off as the most vindictive, cold-hearted bitch on two legs in that segment with Dusty Rhodes last Monday night. Back in 99, I never would have thought that she had it in her. Now, Dixie's a lot older than Stephanie was back then. As a matter of fact, I think Dixie turns 50 next year. We actually share the same birthday, October 6th, as does Bruno Sammartino, which may be the only time I'll ever compare Dixie Carter to Bruno Sammartino. But anyway, if she really embraces the character and embraces whatever hate, I'm talking real hate, she may have for the fans who constantly bash her on Twitter. She's always on Twitter, and people are, you know, they mercilessly made fun of her with that whole hashtag Ask Dixie deal all those weeks ago, which now I noticed on her Twitter, she's using the Ask Dixie hashtag to rub it in everybody else's face. She's using it now as part of her, you know, her heel gimmick. If she can harness that hate and incorporate that into her character, then I think this could work. I know she reads all those comments. I'm sure it hurts her feelings. Good. Take that and make it part of your character and throw it right back in our faces. It has to feel real. As a viewer, I'm not going to buy into it otherwise. I didn't buy into what she was saying on Thursday because we've seen Dixie Carter on television for 11 years now, and not one time in 11 years has she ever behaved the way that she did on Thursday. It just felt like it came out of nowhere. So now it's up to them to explain why Dixie acted the way she did and try to make the fans hate her even more. It's the new direction they're taking the company in. So like it or not, heel Dixie ain't going nowhere. She's here to stay. I just hope they have better luck with this than they did with Aces and Eights. And as one of our listeners, Matthew Davis, wrote in to suggest, and I want to give him props here because I think it would be a great way to handle the situation if it comes to this while getting more heat on Dixie. Her turning heel could lead to her firing Hulk Hogan in storyline as the Impact general manager if he decides not to sign a new contract with the company. I absolutely think they should do that. If Hogan's leaving, it's got to benefit TNA in some way. Well, Hogan leaving would benefit TNA in a lot of ways. But in terms of her character, use it to your advantage. Have her go on the air and fire Hogan. Because all the TNA fans, they love Hogan. They cheer him when he comes out. Believe me, they'll hate her guts if Dixie Carter is the person who takes credit for firing Hulk Hogan on TV. So I wanted to give Matthew credit for that because I think that'd be a hell of an idea. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can also send in audio questions. We don't have one this week, but if you want to send your question in MP3 format to possibly make the air here on the show, you can do so. Send me the attachment, MP3 format only, preferably no more than 30 seconds. And please include your question in written form in the body of the email with the attachment as well. Aiden from Australia, regarding your tweet about Sheamus, I do in fact miss the guy, but this goes long before he got injured. The smiley, happy Sheamus is really depressing to watch because it's such a waste. He has a unique look and is very good as a wrestler, but aside from his one-month-long feud with Mark Henry earlier this year, what was the last serious feud Sheamus was involved in? Maybe the Big Show feud last year? I would love to see Sheamus come back, not as a heel, but I think the crowd would get behind him in a big way if he cut the annoying, obnoxious storytelling attitude and got serious with real opponents. I think he has the potential to have great feuds with guys like Ryback, Lesnar, Punk, and Bryan. He can have a good match with anybody, but has to be serious. What Aiden is referring to in terms of the tweet on Saturday, I sent a tweet out, just a random tweet, asking people, do you miss Sheamus? Because I thought to myself, hey, Sheamus is gone. I almost forgot. I almost forgot that the guy has been off TV now for 2 months, I think. Actually, even less than 2 months, but it feels like he's been gone longer. And I did a Yahoo column on Sheamus only a few weeks ago, you know, pitching an idea for his return. I disagree with Aiden in that while, yes, babyface Sheamus, who was more serious, would be better, I would prefer he come back as a heel, just because I think he would just be more entertaining as a heel. I thought he was infinitely more entertaining as a heel than a babyface, and so I would like to see him go back to doing that. But, you know, I did this column on him on Yahoo a few weeks ago and all this stuff, and I just had this random thought. Hey, oh, Sheamus is gone, so let me ask you guys if you miss him or not. And the overwhelming majority of you guys who wrote back to me was no. And it's not necessarily that all of you hate Sheamus, it's just that you just either didn't realize he was gone or he's just not that important enough a part of the show where WWE has skipped the beat in his absence. I mean, the overwhelming majority, I would say if I got back, I don't even know how many tweets I got back, 30 or 40 tweets at least on the Sheamus thing, maybe there were two or three who said yes. That's pretty overwhelming. And I even made a comment. I thought about sending a similar tweet asking you if you missed John Cena, and then I thought better of it. I said, you know what? I'm asking for trouble if I send that tweet out, because I already know the answer. So that's what he's referring to. And yeah, do I miss Sheamus? Yeah, not really. I'm kind of in the same boat with you guys, and I think part of it is they really didn't have him doing much of anything before he got hurt. You know, he did that, he feuded with the Road Scholars a few months ago, and the Road Scholars weren't doing jack shit. And Sheamus used to be, you know, the number two guy on the roster in terms of baby faces behind John Cena. They pushed him down the ladder a little bit and made him not feel special anymore. So it's no wonder that, you know, when you ask that question, I mean, what are we really missing by Sheamus not being around? If Sheamus was still doing the same stuff he was doing 3 months ago, then who cares? I'd almost rather him not be on TV. Rodrigo writes in, I was thinking of a storyline for CM Punk. It's been reported that Punk has been working injured lately. Well, Punk's always working injured. He's got a hard schedule, and that's what happens. He gets hurt. Anyway, he says, I thought about him feuding with Ryback and losing to him at Battleground, then leaving to sell an injury, which puts more heat on Ryback. CM Punk is written off television until the Royal Rumble, where he returns along with Sheamus and John Cena. Well, I mean, I wouldn't have all three of them come back at the same show. I would spread it out a little bit, but you could have Sheamus come back in the Rumble and save Cena maybe for another big event, or have Cena back at the Rumble and save Sheamus to just come out as a surprise maybe on Raw or something like that. I think it's foolish to have them all on the same show make their return. But Rodrigo's idea is that CM Punk wins the 2014 Royal Rumble and goes on to headline WrestleMania against the WWE champion, hopefully Daniel Bryan. And he says if it is Bryan, Punk can go heel and maybe join the administration as the new face of the company. What do you think? You had me until that last part. Him joining the administration would go completely and utterly 110% against the CM Punk character. And as far as him being the face of the company, I was going to say no. Why would they look at him as the face of the company? I mean, Randy Orton has tattoos just like CM Punk does, but believe me, in storyline, I can't see CM Punk. Just his appearance, his personality, I can't see him being Triple H and Stephanie's first choice as the face of the company. And I can't see Punk going heel and being Triple H and Stephanie's little puppy dog either on TV. Now, Punk winning the Rumble and wrestling Daniel Bryan for the title at WrestleMania, oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I could definitely live with that. And I think there's a chance. I don't think that Punk vs. Bryan for the title headlines the show in that it's the last match to go on. I think just like WrestleMania every year, they come up with those one or two other big marquee matches that take precedent over the titles. I don't like that, but that's just the way they do it. I could see Punk and Bryan wrestling for the title in the third to last match on the show, or second to last, or something like that, like they did with Punk and Jericho at 28 in Miami. Especially if they end up doing Undertaker John Cena or Undertaker Brock Lesnar, really any Undertaker match, I could see headlining next year if they don't get The Rock back. But I don't care. Daniel Bryan and CM Punk for the top title in the company at WrestleMania in front of a crowd of 70,000 people. Sign me up. I would love to see it. Cordell Mitchell writes in, if you had the chance to sit down and interview Vince McMahon, what would be the top two questions you would ask him, given that you could ask him anything you want? Well, once we were already sitting down, I would pull a Russo swerve and ask him three questions instead of two. The first thing I'd ask him is, 1995. What the fuck? Seriously. What the fuck? The second question I'd ask is, Randy Savage, level with me. What's the deal? And the third question would be, Jimmy Snuka, what was in the briefcase? I'm a student of history. I can't help it. I find questions like that to be much more interesting than, you know, why won't you push Dolph Ziggler? Some backstory to the Snuka question, as far as the briefcase mentioned. After Snuka was questioned by police in the death of his girlfriend, Nancy Argentino, he claims in his book that Vince McMahon showed up at the police station with a briefcase. Snuka was never charged with a crime, even though most people think he did it. This is Jimmy Snuka we're talking about, the man who couldn't keep his story straight at the time about what happened that night that she died. So just keep that in mind. But this is what he said in his book. And what makes that little detail so intriguing to me is I remember reading, you know, back in the day when he was putting all the little territories out of business, Vince McMahon would show up with a briefcase full of money to TV stations and markets that aired local wrestling, and he would pay the station, he would pay to purchase their time slots so he could air WWF wrestling. So for Snuka to mention that little detail, for him to mention the briefcase, I find that to be very, very interesting, and I would want to ask Vince McMahon that question. Now, would he answer any of this stuff honestly? Of course, I'm sure he wouldn't. But those are the three questions I would want to ask Vince McMahon. James says, my question this week is in reference to your mention of Mr. Perfect on Sound Off 292. You said the year was 1995 when Perfect returned to WWE as an announcer. Why was he relegated to the announcer role? Was it due to an injury, or did WWE feel he no longer had anything left to offer in the ring? Also, what ultimately led to him leaving the company in favor of WCW? Hennig had a Lloyd's of London insurance policy that he was still collecting on from an old back injury, and they would have stopped paying him had he gotten back into the ring, so they made him an announcer. As far as what led to him leaving for WCW, my understanding has always been that WWF told the insurance company that Hennig was going to be returning to the ring, and as a result, they stopped paying him. Lloyd's of London did, not WWE. So when Hennig found out about this, he was infuriated, and he started negotiating with WCW. They offered him a sweet deal, and off he went. If you'll recall, you know, he was doing the angle with Triple H at the time where they pulled a major swerve on Mark Merrow. Hunter got the Intercontinental belt, and Perfect, I guess, was going to be his manager, but maybe he would start wrestling also. Or maybe he wasn't planning to wrestle, but, you know, Lloyd's of London was told about the angle where he was supposed to wrestle, and they stopped paying him. That's where things get a little murky. Because they were hyping up Mr. Perfect's return to the ring against Triple H on that one Raw episode back in 96. But then they did the fake injury angle backstage where Triple H took out Perfect's knee and Merrow replaced him in the match, which led to the swerve. So that's why he left. Jack from Southampton, England, who is starting a new life out in Sydney, Australia. That's a 24-hour trip right there if you're going from the U.S. to Australia. It's a couple of long flights. So he's probably in the air as we speak, so best of luck to him. He says, I was watching old SummerSlam matches and came across the Owen Hart versus Ken Shamrock Lion's Den match, which was a really good match. What happened to this gimmick? Did they ditch it because it was too close to UFC-style fights? They ditched it because it was Ken Shamrock's gimmick. He came from mixed martial arts, came from cage fighting, and so they tried to replicate that. I think they only did three of them before Shamrock left the company, and they never used it again. He had the one with Owen, he had one with Steve Blackman, and he had one with Vince McMahon on Raw that never really got started because Jeff Jarrett interfered. And I don't think they've used it since, and that would be the reason why. David from Sacramento, California, he has two questions. First, I watched Total Divas and understand the concept of having rookie divas. It's through this, though, that I have grown to despise JoJo. I wanted your thoughts on her. I heard the reason Paige hasn't been pushed to the main roster is because of how young she is, yet JoJo has been on Raw numerous times to promote Total Divas. She seems to be more focused on singing. She should just leave for American Idol. All this plus her hopping from older man to older man. Well, I mean, what do you want the poor girl to do? She works for a company that's made up mostly of older guys. She's 19. Most guys are going to be older than her. There aren't that many guys under contract there younger than she is. I don't have anything against JoJo at all. I didn't watch the entire season of Total Divas, as you're well aware. I tapped out after three episodes, so I don't know how she comes across on the show later in the season, but I don't blame her at all. You want to blame somebody, blame WWE. They're the ones who had that Diva Search audition, and they picked her for the show. All she did was audition. She wants to be on the roster just like everybody else does. If they choose not to bring up Paige, that's their decision. It has nothing to do with JoJo. It's a double standard, though. I do agree. David's second question. When Triple H announced Randy Orton as the new face of WWE post-SummerSlam, it made me really think, has Triple H ever been the face of WWE? I know a lot of his success has been as a heel, but I honestly don't recall him ever being the guy. He's always been overshadowed. HBK outshined him in DX. Rock and Austin were the faces of the company during the Attitude Era. Then Lesnar, then Cena, and now Punk and Bryan. I think Jim Cornette said it best in one of his shoot interviews, and I don't subscribe to everything Cornette has to say, but I just thought this was spot on. He said, Triple H is the guy who works with the guy who draws money. And I just think that's so true. Triple H isn't the guy. He's the guy who fights the guy. He was never really the face of the company. He was a main event player. I said it last week when I was talking about how Mick Foley put him over big in their feud back in 2000, but that's different than calling him the face of the company. And for most of his career, when he had most of his success, it came when he had somebody with him, when he surrounded himself with other people. He had Chyna. She was more over than he was at one point. Then it was DX with Shawn, and Shawn was the star. Then Shawn went away, and he had X-Pac, Chyna, and the Outlaws. Then he had Stephanie, and with that came the McMahon-Helmsley regime. It was the whole group of them. Then it was the two-man power trip with Steve Austin, who was the biggest star in the company. Then he got hurt, came back all jacked up as this big conquering babyface, and his big win at WrestleMania was underwhelming. Very few people cared about that match. That show, that entire WrestleMania 18 show, was built around Hogan versus Rock. That was the real main event. And if he was so over as a babyface and was the man and the face of the company, you'd think they wouldn't have taken the title off him a month later and put it on Hulk Hogan the way they did. He was a flop as a babyface. That title match he had with Undertaker at King of the Ring in 2002 was one of the worst title matches I've ever seen. Especially amongst the top guys like that. Triple H has had awesome matches. Undertaker would have awesome matches sometimes, or very good matches. Undertaker actually had much better matches later on as he got older. He's a freak of nature. It normally doesn't work that way. But that King of the Ring match against Undertaker, who was doing the Big Evil gimmick at the time, was one of the most god-awful matches I've ever seen. So they turned him heel and paired him off with Ric Flair. With Flair in your corner, I think you'll be okay. So then they did Evolution again, surrounding himself with other younger guys. He put Batista over Strong. I'll give him that. He definitely did. Three pay-per-views in a row, in fact. I think Batista beat Triple H in 2005. And then he turned babyface, and he was right back with Shawn Michaels again, doing the DX thing, which is good for an easy pop. They phoned it in there for a couple of years with the DX stuff. That DX stuff couldn't touch what they did in the late 90s. So then he was a single again, and they put the WWE Championship back on Triple H. He had that feud with Randy Orton going into WrestleMania 25, which really wasn't all that good. Yet again, I mean, his WrestleMania title match in the main event is overshadowed by the real main event of the show. And everybody knew it was the real main event, Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker. So now he's back as a heel again, surrounding himself with others as part of the administration or the corporation, whatever the hell they want to call it. Triple H is not a bad wrestler. He's actually really good. The best version of Triple H, my favorite, is from back in 2000 when he first became a main eventer and he was having kick-ass matches every month and working with Foley and working with Rock, and later on he worked with Austin. He was awesome back then. He's good, but he's not the man. He never was. This was a very busy week in wrestling history. 32 years ago, we travel back in time, September 17, 1981. Ric Flair won his first of 16, or 23 if you ask Flair, world championships. He beat Dusty Rhodes for the NWA World Heavyweight title in Kansas City, Missouri. 27 years ago this week, on September 17, 1986... here's a landmark event. At a WWF television taping in Salisbury, Maryland, Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan are made the permanent hosts of Wrestling Challenge, which had previously been called All-Star Wrestling. I think they had done commentary before, but this was their first permanent arrangement together. They would go on to become the most entertaining announced duo in wrestling history. They are my all-time favorite announced team in any sport, form of entertainment, you name it. They are number one. They are the Abbott and Costello of this generation. Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, I think those two combos are right behind them, but Monsoon and Heenan together were just golden. Their chemistry will never, ever be duplicated. It's just not possible. 20 years ago this week, on September 19, 1993, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, WCW held its Fall Brawl pay-per-view in Houston, with the main event of Sting, the British Bulldog, Dustin Rhodes, and the Shockmaster, beating Sid Vicious, Big Van Vader, and Harlem Heat. I bring this up because the legend of the Shockmaster has grown in wrestling lore. He's like this mythical creature, you know, dare I say, larger than a tugboat. I think many of you by now have seen the infamous footage of the Shockmaster's debut on WCW television. It was on an episode of Ric Flair's old talk show, A Flair for the Gold. This was in the period where Flair had come back to WCW, but I think he had like not a non-compete, but I don't think he was allowed to wrestle quite yet, maybe something with his WWF contract. So they had this talk show called A Flair for the Gold. And the idea was the Shockmaster was this new gimmick. It was basically Fred Ottman, who had played Tugboat and Typhoon in WWE. It was him in this weird costume and a Stormtrooper helmet that was just bedazzled in glitter. Somebody thought this was going to be a really good idea. The drugs back in 1993 must have been very strong. And so he was going to come crashing through the wall of the set, and it wouldn't be his voice, but you'd hear the voice that's supposed to be the Shockmaster's voice over the PA system, cutting a promo on Sid and Harlem Heat and Vader. It would actually be Ole Anderson doing the voice. Well, things didn't quite go according to plan, and instead of crashing through the wall, well, actually, he did crash through the wall, but what happened is he tripped and fell as he crashed through the wall and did a face plant on the floor. And in doing a face plant on the floor, the Stormtrooper helmet went flying off his head. And you could hear Ole Anderson doing the dubbed over Shockmaster voice as this was going on. They started playing the tape, I guess, not figuring that he was going to fall flat on his face. So he had to scramble really quick to put the helmet back on his head. He stood up, he brushed the dirt off of him, and it was probably one of the more embarrassing scenes you'll ever see on a wrestling show, which is, looking all these years ahead, there probably have been far more embarrassing segments on TV, which is saying a lot, because this was pretty embarrassing. And it's funny because on commentary, Jesse Ventura, I think maybe this was back when the segment was over, Ventura just lost it. He could not stop himself from laughing at the debacle that we had just witnessed.
What an entrance by the Shockmaster! We're full of spectacular entrances.
17 years ago this week, on September 22nd, 1996, Mark Henry wrestled his very first WWE match, beating Jerry Lawler with a backbreaker at the Mind Games In Your House pay-per-view in Philadelphia. In the main event, Shawn Michaels beat Mankind by DQ after Vader interfered to retain his WWE title. This is one of the greatest championship matches in company history, and one of my favorites. It is the greatest wrestling match that Mick Foley has ever had in his entire career. It's been featured on multiple DVDs. I think it was even on the best of the WWE Championship DVD that they put out earlier this year or last year. And for good reason. It's awesome. And Foley physically looked to be in the lightest weight I've ever seen him for this match, which I'm sure helped his performance. The finish even, the people went crazy for the finish, even though it was a DQ finish, kind of a cop-out. I guess they wanted both guys to look strong, and they didn't want to bury Mankind, because Mankind had been pushed very hard from the moment he came into that company. It's not very often you can point to examples of guys that were put over The Undertaker as strongly as Foley was when he first came in, and Foley beat The Undertaker, for all intents and purposes, fair and square at the King of the Ring in their very first match. Then they had the Boiler Room Brawl, and then they had a Buried Alive match. So beating him, I guess, by DQ is what made sense. After this big melee, Sid came down to attack Vader. They brawled to the back. Mankind gave Shawn the mandible claw, put him out. There was a casket that they had rolled down to the ring. In fact, when Paul Bearer rolled the casket down, Mankind popped up out of it. Because, again, they're mocking The Undertaker. So that casket had been there the whole match, and Paul Bearer is fumbling around, probably waiting to make sure Undertaker got into the casket from under the ring. And he opens the lid, and out pops The Undertaker. And the place just, I mean, you could see the hard camera shaking. That's how crazy people were going for this. And Undertaker made short work of Mankind. And yeah, this was awesome. Everything about this was great. The match was great. The aftermath was great. 16 years ago this week, on September 22nd, 1997, this was a very memorable event in WWE history. Raw aired live for the very first time from Madison Square Garden in New York City, and was a very noteworthy show, as it was the first time Vince McMahon ever took the Stone Cold Stunner from Steve Austin. It also featured the WWE debut of Cactus Jack, who beat Triple H in a New York City street fight. That was the show where we got that memorable Three Faces of Foley promo where Cactus debuted and then came out. 14 years ago this week, on September 21, 1999, talk about hot-shotting a bunch of gimmick matches, at a SmackDown taping in Dallas, Triple H was forced to wrestle five times in one night to earn a spot in the six-pack challenge match being held for the vacant WWE title at that month's Unforgiven pay-per-view. In one night, he lost to the Big Show in a chokeslam match, beat Kane in an Inferno match, lost to Midian and Viscera in a casket match, then beat Mankind in a Boiler Room Brawl before finally beating The Rock in a Brahma Bull Rope match. Ken Shamrock also wrestled his final WWE match on TV here. He lost to Chris Jericho in a First Blood match. You know, Vince Russo left the company to sign with WCW like a week or two after this show, so I'm thinking he knew he was leaving. He knew he was on his way out, and he just said, fuck it. Let's see how many stipulations I can fit onto one show. Good grief. 10 years ago this week, on September 16, 2003... at a SmackDown taping in Raleigh, North Carolina, Brock Lesnar beat Kurt Angle in a 60-minute Iron Man match to win the WWE Championship 5-4. Angle had Lesnar in an ankle lock when the time expired, and Lesnar did not tap. I remember this being an excellent match, but you know, between the fact that it was on a taped show, so you already knew the outcome, and having commercials stuck in the middle of the match, it kind of killed the vibe. A few days later, on September 21st, 2003, Bill Goldberg finally won the World Heavyweight title from Triple H in a match at the Unforgiven pay-per-view, but it was too little too late. The match sucked. They went 15 minutes, or basically 13 minutes longer than they should have. Goldberg just needed to go out there and destroy Triple H very quickly and win the title. especially since Triple H was still nursing a groin injury and couldn't really do much. I mean, Triple H, when he wanted to, can go out there and have a pretty good match. I'm not sure his match with Goldberg would have been that much better had he been 100% healthy, but he definitely wasn't 100% healthy here. So why not go out there, put Goldberg over strong, get Triple H out of there so he can, you know, heal up and rest up and get better. I mean, Goldberg's already limited in what he can do, so the match was just boring and his title win did not have the impact that it should have. And frankly, they fucked up by not having him win the title the month before in that Elimination Chamber match where Goldberg just cleaned house on everybody and the people were freaking out. He was a house of fire in that chamber match at SummerSlam. And then, if you remember, at the end of that match, Triple H hit him with a sledgehammer and pinned him, and that was that. I've talked about Triple H's reign of terror during that 2002 to 2004 period before and how awful it was, how I hated it. It was the dark days of Raw. But the biker shorts period where he was hurt with the groin was even worse. He should have dropped the title quickly, like I said, take a few weeks off, come back, continue the feud, but he just couldn't do it. He couldn't do that. He had to go out there and wrestle. He looked completely ridiculous wearing those tights. I'm surprised it didn't squeeze his insides out. It was so tight, you know, I guess to make it easier for him to get through a match so he wouldn't feel the pain as much, but he had no business being in there. 9 years ago this week on September 20, 2004, we learned that after being knocked down on Raw the week before in the scuffle between Kane and newcomer Gene Snitsky, Lita lost her baby, her little demon baby that she made with Kane. Snitsky then cut a promo saying that it wasn't his fault, which would become his catchphrase.
It's not my fault you fell in love. It's not my fault it came from above. It's not my fault Edge and Lita chose this direction. It's not my fault Kane can't get an erection. It's not my fault the things that love can do to us. Just like it's not my fault you had a dead baby in your uterus.
Everything about this storyline was offensive. Not to me, just to humanity in general. And it was freaking hilarious. 8 years ago this week, on September 18, 2005, WWE held its Unforgiven pay-per-view in Oklahoma City, which included Ric Flair beating Carlito for his first and only Intercontinental title. Matt Hardy beat Edge in a steel cage match. I think the only time poor Matt really ever got revenge on Edge in this feud, and I would argue the most over that Hardy has ever been in his career as a babyface was on this night with this win. He's never gotten back to that level since. He also did a leg drop onto Edge from the top of the cage, which was a highlight reel moment, but in hindsight, it was a really stupid move on his part because he majorly fucked up his tailbone and still suffers today from the effects of that spot. 7 years ago this week, on September 17, 2006, at the Air Canada Centre in Toronto, yet another Unforgiven pay-per-view, which was noteworthy as it featured Trish Stratus beating Lita to become the new women's champion in her retirement match, also a rare occurrence where they actually allowed the hometown hero to go over in their hometown. John Cena beat Edge, who was also the hometown hero that night, even though he was a heel, in a TLC match to become the new WWE champion. And in a handicap Hell in a Cell match, DX beat Vince McMahon, Shane McMahon, and The Big Show after DX pulled down Big Show's trunks and shoved Vince McMahon's head up Big Show's ass. Well, I did say last week that Vince had his head shoved up his own ass. I just forgot that he had it shoved up the Big Show's first. 3 years ago this week, on September 19, 2010, at Night of Champions, Daniel Bryan beat The Miz to win his first championship in WWE, becoming the new United States champion. 3 years later, he'd become the new WWE champion on the same show. Also, Michelle McCool beat Melina in a Women's and Divas title unification Lumberjill match. There's a mouthful. To unify the titles, the women's belt was officially retired from that point on. And 2 years ago this week, on September 18, 2011, at WWE's Night of Champions pay-per-view, there were two title changes and an infuriating finish to the main event. Mark Henry won his first World Heavyweight Championship by pinning Randy Orton clean in the middle of the ring with the World's Strongest Slam. It was a great moment. And a shocking one, too. And credit goes to Randy Orton, because that dude put Henry over strong on not one but two straight pay-per-views. He lost clean to him in Hell in a Cell the month after that. John Cena beat Alberto Del Rio to recapture the WWE title. Del Rio had just cashed in Money in the Bank at SummerSlam the month before and beat CM Punk for the title. So why they felt they had to take the title off him so soon, looking back, I still don't have a good answer. I didn't have one then. I don't have one now. Del Rio ended up getting the title right back anyway. And in the main event, the COO of WWE, Triple H, pinned CM Punk, who at the time was the hottest act in all of wrestling. The dude was on fire. The match saw interference from Miz and R-Truth, who were a team at the time, as well as Triple H's big buddy Kevin Nash, who attacked both men. He left Punk laying with a jackknife powerbomb, but Triple H, clearly much smarter than CM Punk, he left Nash laying with a sledgehammer shot, and then crawled back into the ring, delivered his third pedigree of the match, and pinned Punk 1-2-3. You could argue that, hey, it took three pedigrees and a jackknife over the course of the match to beat CM Punk, and that's true, but you'd be missing the whole point, which is that CM Punk, the hottest act in wrestling, had no business losing to Triple H, the part-time guy, on the show unless the idea was to come back with a rematch, let's say, at Hell in a Cell the next month, and have Punk get his win back before going on to beat Del Rio at Survivor Series, as he did for the WWE Championship. It's great that he won the title. You know, he held it for 434 days. That's all well and good. But it still irks me that Triple H just beat him, and we never got a rematch. If Triple H was some young, dastardly heel and was going to feud with Punk like Orton and Daniel Bryan right now, that's one thing. But tell me, 2 years later, looking back, what purpose did this serve? Why wouldn't Triple H want a title shot after Punk won the belt? Why wouldn't he want the match with Punk at WrestleMania that year instead of the rematch with The Undertaker? And I don't want to hear, oh, well, he's above the title. Give me a break. I guarantee you Triple H slept with that damn belt when he had it each of those 13 times. It would have at least made sense to do the rematch once Punk was champion, do it at WrestleMania, the biggest event of the year, and Punk taps him out, just like Benoit tapped out Triple H at WrestleMania 20, just like John Cena tapped him out at WrestleMania 22. That would have been a huge win for CM Punk. You know, it was bad enough Kevin Nash laid Punk out on TV 3 times with that jackknife, and not once did Punk ever get any real revenge on him for it. They were going to do Punk versus Nash originally on the show. Nash got pulled. They wouldn't clear him. It was for a medical issue. He finally claimed in an interview he was on Plavix. He was taking Plavix for his heart. So Punk never got his revenge on Kevin Nash either. Didn't get it on Triple H, didn't get it on Kevin Nash. But Triple H, oh, the great warrior that he is, he got to beat Punk and Nash. So good for him. Really furthered his career. I'm not naive enough to think that Punk versus Nash would have been this great, wonderful wrestling match. I do think if anybody could have carried Nash at that point in his career to a halfway decent match, it's probably Punk. But I mean, anybody versus Nash at this stage of the game isn't going to be great. I mean, hell, Gravity against Kevin Nash wouldn't be a great match. And even Gravity beat him once when he tore his quad taking a step. Gravity always wins. Just ask the Divas in 20 years. If you have questions for the Sound Off, you could email them to me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster, as we march to 3,000 followers. Facebook.com/thesolemonster is our official profile page. We have a separate closed Facebook group of the same name. If you send a request, I guarantee you I will let you in. I promise. We're closing in on 500 members. Maybe you'll be number 500, so do apply for membership there. And also, don't forget, we are on YouTube. I'm going to be posting more material on there in the weeks and months to come. The Bob Holly book review is up there. I'm thinking about doing some other stuff. So subscribe to our channel, youtube.com/, I don't know what the URL is, but my username on there is The Solemonster. It's all one word. That's how you can find us. And you can hit the little subscribe button, and any new videos that go up, you will be notified of that. So get on there if you're not already on there. And I think that pretty much wraps up all the important stuff for this week. I want to thank each and every one of you for taking 90 minutes or so out of your day to listen to me rant about professional wrestling. I really appreciate it. Actually, we're closing in on 2 hours now, so I have absolutely no concept of time anymore. These shows are getting longer and longer each week, which is bad for me, but good for you. So until next time, we'll be back with episode 294, getting awfully close to episode 300. We're still on target. If we don't miss any shows between now and then, episode 300 is going to fall right on the six-year anniversary of the show in November. So that's pretty cool stuff. Till next week, be well, stay safe. Come on back next week. We'll do it again.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? The fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesalamonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Sala Monster Sounds Off.